comments and views expressed on this program are the responsibility of those who make them. They do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates.
And in government, and the intentions to keep it secret from the American public. And Major Kehoe, being a Marine, was part of the Department of the Navy. And what few people know is that the United States Navy has had the lead in UFOs throughout the history of the phenomenon. And I'm not talking about 1947 or 1941. I'm talking about 1896 at the Portsmouth Naval Yards, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where two SPs, we call them, shore patrol, on board ship, were guarding a ship, and they saw a metallic, oval-shaped craft come floating down the river and overflying the warship that they were guarding. And they actually took a couple of pot shots at it with their rifles and heard the pings and planks of the ricochets. And then the Navy had jurisdiction over the sea lanes. And, of course, the phenomenon we call USOs, unidentified submerged objects. They also were the first to get reports from ships crossing the Atlantic or the famous Bermuda Triangle. The Caribbean was a hotbed. As a matter of fact, you mentioned my long tenure in UFOs. It actually goes back 51 years when I was, I guess I'm going to have to admit my age. When I was 8 years old, my father and I were watching television, and there was a CBS News report about some UFOs tailing an airliner, and they did a rudimentary graphic of this event. And my father jumped out of his seat, and he said, "Oh, my God, that's what I saw. That's what I saw. I never even had a word for it, flying saucers." And then he proceeded to tell me that in 1947-48, when he was a merchant marine sailing the Caribbean, he had been on the crow's nest of this ship that he was on, and he saw this bright light approaching from a far distance, and it was just too bright and too high to be a ship and too low to be an airplane. And so he scurried down and told the pilot, the guy steering the ship, and then he went down and got the captain. When he came back upstairs, the light had really made headway. It was obviously not a ship. The captain was waking up, and he was a Jamaican, and he said, "What's that, man? What is that, man? I don't know. What is that?" And he says that it was so terrifying to them that the pilot, the fellow steering the ship, actually wet his pants. Because as the craft went by, and he described it as going by the ship just about 40 feet high and about 100 feet off the starboard side, that a very smooth sea that they had been sailing all of a sudden started to wave, and a depression was left in the water as the craft went by, and it was actually visible because the craft was luminescent. So that's how far back I go with UFOs, and it was in those years, 56, 57, 58, that Major Kehoe was the foremost spokesman for disclosure of UFOs, and he was the founder of NICAP, and as director of NICAP, he was conducting UFO investigations across the United States, and I saw those programs, including the Alcoa Circle Theater, where they cut off his mic when he started to discuss congressional interest in UFOs. He was a very courageous man. As a matter of fact, there's a wonderful film from 1956 called UFO, The True Stories of Flying Saucers. And it's the story of Al Chop, who was the public relations officer at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and then was transferred to the Pentagon and had to handle the press when they had the 1952 Washington, D.C. flyovers. And so this is kind of a, we would call it to get today, a docudrama.
Mm-hmm.
With Tom Powers playing Al Chop. It is the most realistic and the most serious film, I think, of the time. And incidentally, Major Keogh makes an appearance in this film without credit, dressed up as an Air Force colonel investigating the death of Captain Thomas Mantell, on whose day of the day of his death was the day I was conceived down in New Orleans, my mammy and my pappy,
uh-huh.
January 7th, 1948. So Mantell is a big figure in all of this, and one of the reasons they were so mortified about revealing anything to the public and had to come up with, smoke screens is the perfect word for it, to deflect public attention and fears, because Thomas Mantell was not up there chasing the planet Venus, you know?
No, nor was it swamp gas, nor
was
it flares.
Nor was it a balloon.
Yeah.
You know, he said, it's a huge metallic object, it's just above me, and... It's, you know, I'm very gratified to speak about Captain Mantell, because I had a very interesting thing happen to me flying over Connecticut in the year 2000 on May 6th, in the middle of the night, 9:30 at night over Connecticut, pitch black, only road lights and little town lights. All of a sudden, everything lit up, and I looked, and I looked to my left. I was flying toward New York, so...
Now, were you piloting the plane?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, I've been flying since 1984, and I've flown hundreds of hours in the Northeast. I've flown... I actually flew the Mount Rainier flight when I was out in Washington in 1990. I made a point of renting a plane and going out with a mountain pilot guide to get the eyeball, you know, the eyeful of the... Kenneth Arnold sighting. So I flew the Mount Rainier. I've flown the Alps. I've flown the San Andreas Fault. Most of my flying has been around here. So on that night, May 6th, the whole landscape lit up, and I looked over to the south, and I could see Long Island and Long Island Sound illuminated as if it was late afternoon or late afternoon sunset. And my brain went, what? Did I miss the dawn? I mean, it was so incongruous to be pitch black at night and to see this. And then I looked, and I looked forward, and I saw green light all over the landscape and hills. And I looked again, and then I looked up. And that's when I saw an object coming down from outer space, brilliant, as bright as the sun, reflecting off both. I could see the Atlantic. I could see the mass of Long Island Sound, and I could see Long Island Sound reflecting this light. And I saw this thing drop out of the sky and make two hops, incredibly rapid hops. And it changed direction. It dropped almost, my mind looked at it, it's dropping vertically. And what I thought of was a spider dropping down on a silk thread. So it hits the heavier air region of the atmosphere, did two bounces, and it's coming right at me, and I had to deflect the airplane. What this was a meteor, and this meteor passed within 75 feet of my aircraft, and I had to maneuver to avoid being hit by the meteor, and then I had to avoid this column of smoke, poisonous gases that were coming out of it, out of its tail. The tail was 100 feet long. And I said to myself, my God, if I fly through that tail, kaboom, you know,
mm-hmm.
pilot error. And I saw and I had to maneuver around the column of poisonous smoke. But I thought of Captain Mantell, and I wrote an article about it, and dealt with UFOs. But it was just this was one instance that I feel this was is really a very big meteor that almost knocked me out of the sky.
Well, and a good point here, you're a pilot.
Yes.
You were able to tell that it was a meteor.
Exactly.
And one of the things that really gets me going is media reporting when you can tell. And I go on when there's a big UFO sighting somewhere, I go on the air here and I tell people, okay, now watch for this. The spin is going this direction.
Right.
And I really get upset with the media for doing that, and I'm very vocal about it. But one of the things that they love to say is, well, there was a meteor shower, and maybe that's what people saw. You know, look, come on.
We
can tell what we're looking at. Yeah. We know if it's a meteor.
Right. I wanted to say, just to finish off this meteor incident, because I have had close encounters in the air with a real, I'm telling you, that was a meteor. I'm going to tell you another story about two UFOs that buzzed the nose of my plane in March of 1990. But I just wanted to say that after I wrote this article about this encounter and touched upon Captain Mantell's death and how unfair it was to besmirch his reputation after he did such a courageous thing, I received a letter, an email from his grandson thanking me for the article. And he said to me, you know, my grandfather was a great man. My grandfather was a hero. And I wrote back to him, yes, your grandfather was a hero, and he's been a big part of my life all my life. I've always been aware of Captain Thomas Mantell. And, you know, I do this work really for the people, the American people, the people who are brave enough to come out and say what they saw, to tell the truth. And then I think it's criminal of the government and the authorities to victimize the victim, you know?
Yeah.
That just sticks in my craw. And that's why I admire people like Major Kehoe, Stanton Friedman, the people that, many of my friends are noted on your guest list here, and I'm very, very, you know, pleased to be in contact with you and to affirm that we are telling the truth and we are on the right track, and people who lie to themselves will never get to the right place or come to the right conclusion. So the smoke screen started very early on, and I believe there was the Mantell incident, plus the other things. You know, there were a lot of other planes that were falling out of the sky, and because the Air Force was belligerent. Of course, they had to take incursions into our airspace. It's a very serious affairs. Whether they be bomb runs, you know, as we were expecting from the Russians, or spy missions, you know. Our airspace is sacrosanct. It's sacred airspace, and every nation protects it. But the way this was handled has not produced good results, you know. It has led to rule by secrecy. I just received a wonderful book. Ironically, I received it because the title has my name. It's called Morning Star Pass by Victor Norgaard.
Mm-hmm.
That's not his real name. But when he heard about the recent events and plans for disclosure or attempts to disclose, including the UN meeting, he wrote to me and he said, you know, I was really excited to hear about this event, and I wrote a book about disclosure years ago, and it has your name. I hope you're not offended. I said, of course not. Why should I be offended? I'm actually quite gratified that somebody has something that I call prescience. You know, we have this thing called science, but we have this other word in the English language, which is a wonderful word, and it's like pre-science, but it's pronounced prescience.
Mm-hmm.
And this is knowing something before, to know before. So like ESP and those kinds of things.
Right.
Prescience. And great writers, great thinkers, scientists often are in tune with world events as they unfold, and they can feel them before the unfolding occurs. And I always say to people, you know, great events, coming events, cast their shadows before them. And there are people who can feel a shadow, you know, and react to it before the object hits them. So Major Kehoe was a visionary, a serious man, a dedicated officer, a gentleman, and a truth seeker. And that's what I think all of us who are engaged in UFO research are after. We're seeking the truth. And it's something that's really fundamental to having a good life and to having a clear conscience, a good mind, knowing where you stand on this planet, knowing where you're going, where you came from. Graham Hancock, you know, the great English writer whom I met in New York in 2006, likes to say that mankind is a species with amnesia. We don't know where we came from. We don't know how we got here. We don't know who we are. Mankind's origins are a mystery. And I think that we are, you know, we're getting to it. We're finding out, both through ufology and genetics, we're finding out a remarkable amount of information about our own makeup, what makes us human beings. And it's dovetailing with religion, really. I think one of the great obstructions to disclosure is that science will have to admit that it really is limited, doesn't know very much, and the theory is converging on something that indicates that what is told in the legends of world civilizations and the religious texts around the world, including the Bible, I'll use the Bible as the prime example since most of our listeners are familiar with that rather than the Mahabharata, which I'll touch upon a little later. But the Bible says, you know, angels came out of the sky, they looked upon the daughters of men, they were comely, which means they were pretty beautiful, and they were drawn to them. And that's just a couple of sentences in the second chapter of Genesis, but the whole story is actually told in the book of Enoch. And some angels interfered with the evolution of mankind, and mankind developed more rapidly than he would have had there been no interbreeding. So many, many people walking the earth today are half human and half angel. And others, in more recent times, there are quite a few who may have an alien gene inserted biologically, genetically engineered into their makeup. And this is something that intrigues me and something that I've been following. The genetic part of it, you know, the abduction, the sexual manipulation of the victims, et cetera, from the time of Betty and Barney Hill. But I've been aware of this since the 1960s, because in 1962, my 7-year-old brother was snatched away in upstate New York, you know, and he didn't see any flying saucer, you know. We had nothing to relate to this thing that happened to him, except that he became distraught while staying upstate on a farm upstate during the summer, and he didn't want to be there anymore, and he insisted on coming back to the city, New York City, where we live, where he was born, where we grew up. And when he came back, I said to him, Rudy, you know, what happened? You know, you were so happy to be going to the country and to be with riding horses and everything on the farm. And he says, Robert, I got scared. I said, oh, scared? Scared of what? He says, something happened. I said, what? He said, that the first night that I was sleeping there, the farmer had me sleeping in his son's room, and I heard these little voices. And so, I was interested. So I went to the window to look. I pulled up the shade, and there was nothing there. I went back to the bed. And then I heard these little voices again.
Robert, I hate to do it. We're into a break. We'll have to catch the rest of that when we come back.
Okay, remind me to talk about what my brother said.
All right.
He saw some munchkins in the flower pot.
Okay. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Don't go away, and we'll get into the breaking news here in just a moment. Thank you.
the door, taking the day. The rentals, yeah, they're gone anyway. When you crash, you know I'll stay. So why don't we listen now? What they do, what they say. I think we can make it a better way. So dream the day, try to be different now. Try to be different now. Can you play it up and down tonight? So we can get up off our chair. Lay back off for the makeup, time's up. Yesterday, gonna be back home tonight. Oh yeah, yeah. Open the door, taking the day. Yeah, they're gone anyway. When you crash, you know I'll stay. You gotta read this and that. What they do, what they say. Don't think we can make it a better way. So dream the day, and try to be different here. Try to be I'm all alone. They don't know where I'm coming from. A lot of give and a lot less take. When I know that day is done, just wanna be close to anyone. Guess I'll just close my eyes and dream the day, yeah, yeah. Open the door, take in the day. The rentals, yeah, they're gone. I'll stay. Why don't we listen to what they do, what they say? I think we can make it a better way. Dream that day, yeah, yeah. Open the door, take in the day. The rentals, yeah, they're gone.
We're back. My guest this evening is Robert Morningstar, and when we cut away, I had to interrupt you as you were telling us about your brother.
Yes. So the upshot was that he had a very, very strange experience with some rather little creatures. As I said, he had heard these voices. He went back to bed. He heard them again, and he said, "Robert, I knew I wasn't asleep. I was awake, and I could hear them. So this time I snuck up to the window, and I pulled up the shade very quickly, and I caught them by surprise. And there were these three little guys." Those are his words. "These three little guys, they were really small, and they were hiding in the flowers. And when they saw me, they looked at me with these big eyes." He says, "I thought they looked like munchkins. Their voices were like munchkins." That's what he said. And, you know, like "We Are the Lollipop Kids."
Uh-huh.
Those high-pitched voices. He said, well, he says, it was like they were like munchkin voices. And they looked at me and they said, "You don't see us. We're not here. We're only flowers. You don't see us. We're not here. We were only flowers." And they said it a third time. And then he said he was just totally, totally mortified. And then he didn't remember much except waking up in the morning with the window open and the door open and feeling horrible. And at that time, he became very distraught. He had nightmares. He couldn't sleep. He was despondent. And the farmer called the family and said, "Look, you know, your son is just crying all the time, and he wants to go home, and I don't know what to do with him." So he came back, and that was when, you know, I was alone with him in a room. I was 12, he was 7. And that I said, "Rudy, what happened? You know, I just don't understand this." And so that was his story, and that's when I became aware that these very strange things were happening up in the Hudson Valley. And I've watched that for many years. I've seen many UFOs while flying, while on the ground. I've had several close encounters of various kinds. And I try to help people. I went to Fordham University here in New York. I was a Regents Scholar. And I got my degree in psychology because of my interest in parapsychology. And after graduation, since that was really basically a dead field in academia in America, First of all, it was denied anybody who was seriously involved in it, like J.B. Ryan at Duke University. He was just sitting in there with a bunch of people doing tests with Zener cards. You know what Zener cards are?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's not where it was at, you know, as far as I was concerned, because I myself and members of my family have had this gift of, you know, psychic abilities, telepathy, precognition, premonitory dreams, things like that. It's common in the family, you know. So I pursued independent studies in parapsychology. I became involved with a U.S. Navy program I volunteered for in college, run by IBM and the Office of Naval Intelligence, in developing artificial intelligence. 1969, that was the first time I heard the term, and I wondered what it was, and my professor said, well, Bob, what I'm doing is I'm measuring brain voltages, electrical voltage, and brainwave functions, and I'm mapping neural networks. And when I get my work done and I've mapped the neural networks, which are the nerves involved in the functions of different faculties, you know, like speech and vision, geometry, nonverbal things.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to put that in a computer, and I'm going to make a computer learn to think like a human being. And I said, well, that's great. And he invited me to become part of this program. And I volunteered for it. And I went through an experiment like you see on the History Channel now, where they cover your eyes with white goggles, and they cover your ears and feed you white noise. And I went through it and came out of it and felt great about it. But it took 33 years for me to realize that the good professor had only told me half the story. Yes, he was mapping my neural networks and measuring brainwave functions and electrical activity to teach a computer how to think like a human being. But it's kind of like the Bourne identity. Bourne identity gave me the word for this thing I'm going to tell you. They had actually put in digital information through the earphones that was fed to my brain and my subconscious and remapped my neural network so that I can think like a computer.
Cool.
not bad, you know. A lot of stuff like this was being done in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and we know them as MK Ultra, MK Naomi, MK, another one called Artichoke, all kinds of studies that were being done, you know, secretly. And I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, and I'm not a victim in any way because I was curious, you know. Curiosity killed the cat, but satisfaction brought him back. They never tell you that last part, right? Every time I say that, people say, oh, I didn't know that last part. Yeah, well, it's true. Satisfaction brought him back. So anyway, I've had a great life, a wonderful life. I've had many adventures. I use my brain to the fullest, and I use it for the good.
And
I think that this was part of the program, that they needed people who could go into these fields, parapsychology, ufology, ghosts, you know, ectoplasm, and find out what was going on. And in going into fields that they can't go into openly. You see? And so I feel that, you know, that's how I wound up being on the Kevin Smith Show tonight.
Well, it may be entirely. Now, another point is it certainly, I would think, would have aided you in the investigation that you've done into this... at this point, I will call it alleged meeting that took place at the UN on February the 12th. having to do with UFO disclosure.
Yes.
Let me bring you up to date on where the audience is with this.
Okay.
When it first, the information first came out, I reported it on the show. Within a couple of days, you had some of the luminaries in ufology saying, you know what, we don't think this thing actually happened because this Frenchman, Laurent, had some inaccuracies in his CV and his resume, and so we can't trust the information.
Right.
When those reports started coming out, see, my background is I'm a cop. I used to be.
Well, you're a good cop.
Well, I think so.
I know.
I was, but I was a cop for years, and so when this started coming out, I backed off and I said, oh, "Wait a minute, that's totally unrelated."
That's correct.
If a guy says he's been pretending to be a doctor and he's practicing medicine without a license, and then he's a witness to a homicide, does the fact that he had no license to practice medicine have anything to do with the fact that he saw the homicide? No.
You're perfectly correct.
Absolutely, totally unrelated. Right. And so I took the position here on the show. I said, look, I'm going to back off of this thing, and I think everybody else should, and let's let it percolate for a while, because, you know, he's Laurent, if you take him out of the equation, you still have source A. Since then... Dick Criswell has called into the show and has been on the show, and he said that he has a source, a naval commander, who told him that the meeting did take place. And
is this the fellow out in the West Coast?
Dick Criswell?
Yeah.
No, he's up in the sort of Northeast.
Oh, then we may be talking about the same person.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
because that's who told me about it.
So anyway, I said, if you unplug the Frenchman, you still got two sources, and you know, let's wait and see how this works out. It looks to me like there's probably some truth in the story.
Well,
all right, now you
me,
have been able, yeah. You've been able to determine that there is truth in the story.
Well, I believe the man who told it to me. He presented his credentials to me. Let me just backtrack a little bit to tell you how this came about. On June 24th, 2007, there was the UFO Culture of Contact conference here in New York, and I appeared there. And two gentlemen, two brothers named Sean and Clay Pickering, did a presentation. And they told the story of this fellow, a military man whom they had met, befriended, became buddy-buddy, and he trusted them and was impressed by their knowledge and on UFOs, and he shared some information with them, and it was the existence of SOM 1-01, which is Special Operations Manual 101. Have you heard of it? I'm sure you know it.
I have heard of it. I cannot say that I could...
It's the recovery manual.
Yeah.
It's the U.S. Air Force recovery manual for how to go about, you know, collecting the stuff, packaging it, what you might find, what kind of aliens, et cetera, et cetera. Now, people in the audience didn't know SOM 101 from, you know, from DDT, but I did because I've been studying the old one for over 10 years. So I jumped out of my seat, and they came off stage. I ran right up. I said, whoa, fellas, you know, can I see that? And I looked at it, and having been familiar with the old version, the SOM-101, that came from the photographs, you know, that had been reprinted, the manual in that era was photographed secretly with a camera, and so the hand was holding the book, folding it over, and the curve of the book resulted in some of it being in sharp focus and some of it being in soft focus and the other part
Somewhat distorted. Now, we're into a break. We'll have to catch this on the other side. All right, folks, you see, I told you. We'll be right back.
Kevin Smith Show selects one of its very best shows each week and turns it into a free podcast? Well, it's true. You can download free Kevin Smith Show podcasts right now and get a free fresh podcast each week. Do you want to start building your own library of Kevin Smith Shows? All you have to do is visit our website at kevinsmithshow.com and click the free podcast link. They're yours for the download.
All right, when we went away, Robert, you were talking about the fact that you met these two guys, Clay and Sean Pickering.
Right.
You wanted to see the manual. You took a look at it, and then we had to take a break.
Okay, so I looked at the manual, and every page was crystal clear. So, and there were details in it. There were many more pages, and there were details in it that were identical to the other manual, but there were others that were more refined. But the fact was that all of the pages were crystal clear, and it had been Xeroxed. So it was a different source. It was not the same thing remodeled, you know?
Uh-huh.
So they appreciated my expertise. They said that they would like me to look it over, read it, and write up something about it, you know, sort of validation. So we made a plan to get together and get a copy to me, and it took a while, in 6 months or so. But then in January, finally, we got together over a couple of drinks. They gave me the copy, and I was amazed by it. So our friendship developed. And then in February, on the 11th, they talked to me and said, hey, something big is coming up. This friend of ours, our contact source, told us he's coming to New York, and he's going to be at a meeting at the United Nations tomorrow at 8 a.m. And don't say anything about it, because, you know, we don't know if it's going to go down. It's going. We'll know tomorrow night. And then we'll bring in and tell you all about it. So I waited. The next day they talked to me and they said, hey, yes, it happened. So, you know, we want to put something out about it, because here's the situation. I began with Major Kehoe in the United States Navy, premier agency, in the lead agency in investigating UFOs. I want to say to the audience, despite all the denials that we've gotten from every branch of government as to the existence of the UFOs, starting with the Army Air Force, and then it split off into Army and Air Force, they have always denied the UFO. The one agency that has never denied the existence of UFOs is the United States Navy. And it's the United States Navy, through people like Major Kehoe, Admiral Hillenkoetter, who was the head of the CIA, Admiral Sidney Sewers, who was also head of the CIA, kept pushing for disclosure. They said, this is serious, this is real. As a matter of fact, it was Admiral Hillenkoetter, on February 28, 1960, who revealed the existence of the memo, Flying Saucer, Serious Business. Everyone knows the Frank Edwards book, and they think he made up the title. No. He got a copy of the Air Force Regulation 2002. He named it in the New York Times. He said the Air Force is shutting up its people, telling them not to talk, but internally they say flying saucers are serious business. So Frank Edwards took out the R and just said flying saucers, serious business. But in that interview that Admiral Hillenkoetter gave to the New York Times in February of 1960, he named AFR 200-2. And that, in fact, in the interview that we are discussing, the Major Kehoe-Mike Wallace interview, was what Major Kehoe was exposing, and Mike Wallace was denying. Kehoe said there were four documents, and...
Let me just...
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
That blows me away. Mike Wallace is talking with Major Donald Kehoe...
Right.
Who is a Marine pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Wallace is a journalist.
Right.
Major Kehoe is telling about something that is an internal document having to do with pilots.
Right.
And Mike Wallace thinks he's smart enough to deny it?
He is smart-ass enough, I would say, you know? Well, you know, these guys are paid talking heads, and they have to, toe the party line. They do not research the news. Mike Wallace is not going out there beating out the bushes and looking for the evidence. They have their sources, and they get fed their pieces, and they don't even write them themselves. But what galled me, and why the reason I wrote this article, the UFO smokescreen, was because in 1957, all of these things that I'm talking about were top secret and were still, closed up. And there, he has the gall to be facing an officer, a gentleman, a pilot, a marine, and denying the existence of these documents while he's holding, a quote from one of them in his hands. You know, the one thing that he does quote is from the Robertson Report, and it's totally out of context. He tells them only a little piece of their third conclusion to try to debunk Major Kehoe. And Kehoe is such a gentleman. He collected himself, and he knew what he could say and what he couldn't say, and he didn't want to look really angry. But that picture in the opening just really tells it all, because the man knew, Mr. Major Kehoe knew that the guy was lying through his teeth.
Well, now, the same sorts of things happen. I mean, look, you had hundreds of people that saw this amazing and apparently gigantic UFO in Stephenville, Texas. You have an Air Force spokesman who says, don't know what it was. We didn't have anybody up there. And then he comes back the next day and says, oh, hey, you know what? I forgot. We had some F-16s up there. Right. And, what blows that away, what really blows that cover, is you have other pilots who said, yeah, we saw them. Yeah. Chasing the UFO, we saw the UFO, we saw the planes, we know what planes look like. Yeah, we saw the F-16s, and they were chasing the UFO.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? The big thing is they never talk about the proximity of this event to the Bush, Texas White House, if you wanted, the Texas Ranch.
Yeah, Crawford. It's 40, 50 miles away?
Okay. How fast can you cover 40 or 50 miles when you're doing 3,000 miles an hour?
Pretty quick,
Know what I mean?
Yeah, pretty quick.
I feel sorry for the colonels, they usually get a colonel, to go up there and face the music. Like the guy who came out with the Air Force finding on Roswell and said it was dummies from the Mogul test. Weather balloon from the Mogul test, but dummies from parachute research that they were doing. And the thing was that the dummies from the parachute research, those experiments were done in 1953, and we're talking about 1947 in Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
And they just have to steel themselves and grit their teeth and just go out there under orders and mouth these lies. So I really feel sorry for these fellows,
You know what I say all the time, Robert, and I said it as recently as last week. Come on, guys. We understand if you need to use a cover story, but get some better script writers.
Exactly. But why need a cover story when we have 60 years of experiences and now they are appearing all over the place, which brings me to the point of this meeting, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The meeting occurred because the Stevensville event is so embarrassing. I mean, do you have confidence in the U.S. Air Force after they come out and lie about Roswell and lie about a blatant thing like Stevensville's? That one took the cake, And this has been an embarrassment to all the branches of all of the services, right? Because it makes all of them look bad. And these officers, the military, they are dedicated, patriotic people. And they didn't sign up to be big liars to the American public.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a crisis of confidence in them and between them and the American public for whom they work. I want to remind every military man listening today, you do not work for the United States government. You work for the American people. The American people pay your bills, buy your clothes, give you your food. It is not the government. The government represents the people, and we better start remembering that, right? Because this country is in a crisis, and this big lie is part of it. The cover story, the cover of Morningstar Pass by Victor Norgaard says, absolute secrecy breeds absolute power. You see? And
we, I hate to do it, we're into our top of the hour break. We'll be back in just a few minutes, folks, and more from Robert Morningstar. And what is it that's shaking the earth right now about UFOs?
Kevin Smith at 1-800-289-1092.
Let me welcome those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour. We're talking with Robert Morningstar, and we're talking about this meeting that took place
at the United Nations having to do with UFO disclosure. Did the meeting take place? And how sure are we?
Okay, Robert, so I forget where we were, but
we were discussing the meeting. I did a sidetrack to the military cover-ups and the embarrassment that it caused the services when the Stevensville event occurred. And so it turns out that because of the current leadership in the Joint Chiefs of Staff and National Intelligence Directorate, I think these fine officers have had enough, and a certain group of individuals, a working group, started to work on devising a way of getting out of the big lie, basically, plain language, how to extricate themselves from 60 years of lying and restore faith and confidence both in the military, the word of the military, and in the American government. So the way that it's going to apparently come down is that no government wants to come out first and say, yeah, we knew the UFOs were true and we had to lie for this or that reason. They feel that it would be better if an umbrella organization like the United Nations broaches the subject to the world public, and then it takes them all off the hook to some extent. You know, they don't come out and fess up. So this meeting was called for February 12th. I was advised that it was going to happen. I was advised later that it did happen. When the event was announced by Dr. Michael Sala, you know, all of his critics came down on him really harshly. And since I was in the background, I felt it was very unfair, because some were accusing him of making it up, trying to make money, you know, in exopolitics, etc. And I knew the facts, you know. And so I wrote a letter, saying an article in UFO Digest about the UN meeting, and saying that it's unfair to ask for the identity of the source, because that would put him in great danger. And I quipped on another radio show. I said, if these people had their way, the person that we called Deep Throat would never have lived, and he would have been Slit Throat.
I said exactly, well, not exactly. I said almost the same thing.
More or less the same thing.
I said, you know, the mainstream media comes out every day with some story that they say sources close to the White House say.
Right.
And the public just eats it up, and you know, an anonymous source said this, and the public eats it up and buys it. But when we come to UFOs, ufology eats its own.
Right. Well, that's because ufology has become a religion. And there are all these parishes, you know, parochial interests, you know. Oh, I own Roswell. Don't talk about Roswell. That's my thing, you know. Uh-huh. Oh, Shag Harbor is my specialty. You know, I'm the great boombah of Shag Harbor. And the parochialism, basically, of it is consuming it, really, because it creates a lot of factionalism and a lot of infighting, and I'm not involved in that. I am a completely independent investigator. And you're going to have one of our investigators on tomorrow, I understand. Eric Taylor?
That's correct.
The Sorrels?
Uh-huh.
This gentleman, he's a young fellow, came out of the blue and wrote me an email. I get letters to the editor, and I try to answer all of them, you know, except, you know, the really insulting ones. Like, I don't get into that, you know.
Uh-huh.
Sticks and stones will pick my bones. Words will never hurt me. But this kid, I think he's about 18 or something, he took it upon himself to investigate. So he sent me his report, and I said, why don't we work on this and write it up? And we're doing this now at UFO Digest. We're conducting investigations by helping people get to the sources, giving them advice on how to go about it, helping them edit their material to make it more cohesive, coherent, repertorial. We're investigating an event in Canada at Colwickian Hospital in Duncan, British Columbia, which is a fascinating event, and you'll hear about that another time. Let's stick to the UN. So the UN thing happened, and I wrote that the concerns are serious. Look at concerns. First, they have to own up to a whole new field of physics and energy management and energy sources. Okay, that puts all those the oil gluttons on the hot seat. Because by denying the existence of this field of physics, which Richard Hoagland calls hyperdimensional physics, they have quashed the research and development of alternate sources of fuel and energy. UFOs prove that there's another source, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so that would have to be integrated into a new paradigm, a totally new paradigm of science. Then there's the religion issue. You know, how are people going to react to the existence of these other intelligences, some human-like, and some completely non-human, right? And they seem to be vying for dominion, control, domination of resources, and people are some of the resources, apparently, that one group is interested in for the genetic engineering reasons that I mentioned earlier. So these are serious concerns. And one of the concerns was the religious reaction to disclosure. How would it affect the world's great religions? Which was the subject of the Brookings Institution report in 1967, which led to this policy of denial. Because, ironically, they said that most of the common people on the planet Earth would be able to adjust to disclosure very easily. But it would be the scientists, the engineers, and the doctors, and the professionals who have a vested interest in their status and their preeminence as the greatest intelligences that have ever evolved on the planet Earth. They would kind of had to go back to the kindergarten seat and admit that they are not the all-knowing, omniscient individuals that they think they are. And the Brookings Institution said that they would be so despondent with the idea of having to catch up with a civilization and a science that was 200, 300 years ahead of us that they might not even get out of bed to go to work the next day. So that's the reason, is to protect the status of the elite, or the self-styled elite. So the religious issue is a big one. And so people poo-pooed it. Oh, come on, religion. And I said to on the radio program, listen, do you recall that about 11 years ago, or even longer maybe, about 30 people committed suicide out in San Diego, the Heaven's Gate cult, because they believed a UFO was going to come down and collect their souls and take them away? They were worried that the people who go through a crisis of faith might react negatively, and not just negatively, violently, you know, getting their guns and shooting up the extraterrestrials, but just being despondent that their core beliefs might be threatened. And so this disclosure is going to have to involve an integration of belief systems in a way that is not mentally toxic, emotionally.
Well, I agree with that. It's not going to be sudden either. It takes a while for people to become accustomed to the idea, and apparently that's what this entire UN meeting was about.
That's
was
right.
To acclimate the world's mm-hmm. population to the idea.
Yeah,
so let's get into. You had a chance to examine the credentials of this source that Michael Sala was quoting.
Yes, I did. And I have to protect him. You see, that's my main concern. I respect him. He's shared information with me, but I do have an obligation to protect his identity, but also to protect his career and his life. And the same for people in Europe who are doing the same thing. And I will talk about the French Rear Admiral who wrote to me over the weekend, who's written to the President of France, calling for a serious disclosure and investigation.
Okay, let's get into that in a moment. But first,
let me
you met this person, right? You met
many times
Source.
Now. Many times now. Five times we've met. And as a result of reading my report in UFO Digest defending Michael Sala and saying that I had heard about it and that his anonymity must be respected to protect him, and touching on the religious issues, I was contacted and told, listen, they want to talk to you. It was a week later. They want to talk to you. They read your stuff in Washington, and they said, and this was a quote, they said, finally, there's a rational person in ufology that we can talk to. Let's talk to this guy and bring him up to speed. So I had a dinner meeting with him. He brought his credentials. He's a military liaison diplomat working both with the Department of Defense and with the State Department. And he was sent after the UN meeting to contact nations, the military liaison diplomats in the NATO nations, to broach the subject of how to go about disclosure. And what they came back with, or what he came back with, is this, and it's the same feeling in our military. Our military is dedicated, sworn to uphold the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. They are honorable men, and they follow orders. They will not mutiny. They will not go out on their own and do something mutinous. What they want is the support of the public. They want the public to get the pressure on the politicians to make them do what they want to do. They want to disclose. They want to be honest. They want to come up with a new paradigm that will restore their respect, their honor, their self-esteem, because these guys cannot feel too good about themselves having to lie. Like that fellow down in Stevensville. Oh, I found the 10 F-16s. I'm sorry it took me 2 weeks to find them, you know? That's not good for morale. That's not good psychology. So what they want is the help of the American people to put the pressure on the politicians so the politicians do the right thing and give the orders to the military to disclose. Pretty simple, isn't it?
Well, you would think so.
You would think so, except the vested interests and the controlling powers, primarily financial powers, bankers, oil men, the energy industries, all of the people who have their bucks rolled up in the current energy system.
I got to tell you, disclosure or no disclosure, those gas prices at the pump go much higher.
Yeah.
And what's going to happen is all of that will come tumbling down around the ears of the politicians that support it. And not all politicians support it.
It's worse than that.
Mm-hmm.
It has started to affect the food supply.
Yep, there's rationing already.
Rationing already, but the food supply is in danger because the diversion in this sham that was pulled on us about ethanol, you know, the development of ethanol, has taken the grains and the crops that used to go to feed animals and make them, you know, supply the steak and the pork chops on the dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
The price of the feed, the grain feed for the animals, has skyrocketed, and now the prices of food are skyrocketing. And in New York, I'm in shock. In just the last 2 weeks, things have been going up 15% and 20%, you know, in price. There have been food riots in other parts of the world. They have really screwed the pooch this time, you know? And it's when, not just the gas, but when the food on the table starts to be threatened, you're going to have a very angry public, and they better get this under control very, very fast. And the solution is develop this new system of physics that will provide the energy. You know, I'm a pretty good electrician, physicist myself, and I've worked on self-propelled electric magnetic motors that use magnetism to drive themselves, and the spinning vortex of the magnetism of the magnetic field will create energy. But I've sat on this for about 8 years because why? Well, people get killed. Look at Dr. Maylov, you know? Remember Dr. Eugene Maylov?
Yeah.
He was into zero-point energy.
Mm-hmm.
Poor man is murdered in his driveway in Maryland, and nobody's ever been caught. But listen, it's not just our domestic people who are involved in maintaining the supremacy of oil. Foreign powers, like Saudi Arabia and Russia. Russia is in an oil glut. Do you think that Russia wants to see its cash cow, slaughtered, basically, by the introduction of a new energy technology? So it's a very, very difficult situation politically and economically. And we're going to have to face it. And it's devolving right now.
All right. Now, in this meeting, mm-hmm. The source, you've verified the credentials. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And was he the chair of the meeting?
No, he did not chair the meeting. He was, I would say that he was co-chair. Somebody from the United Nations was the chair and an identified person. There were representatives from about 30 countries there, and there were about 40 people present. The room where it occurred has been kept secret. But the fact is, he's told me how to go about finding out the information. You know, he wants me to find it, and he's told me one way to do it, and I told him another way that I'm going to do it. But I can't divulge that to you, because everybody would be doing it. But I have contacts with the United Nations, and after this event occurred, my contact there, who was with an NGO, non-governmental organizations that have seating there, one that has something to do with a space society, wrote back to me. She said that there's a real buzz going around. There's some excitement. Something did happen. So I was laying low on this, and then Laurent came out with his revelations of the follow-up meetings of February 13th and 14th. The whole world came down on Laurent. I feel sorry for the man, but you know what? I think that he is the point man, that he may have been induced to go up by the French military, with whom he definitely had a lot of contacts. And perhaps they said to him, listen, Laurent, we need someone to go out there and sacrifice himself for a short period of time. It would be very difficult, but you will get the word out. Well, he got the word out, and what did he get? He got smashed down. The man's been around for years. His credentials have been published for years. And then all of a sudden, as you pointed out, they come down nitpicking, four letters in his resume. And I don't know anybody who doesn't pad their resume, you know? So that is not a basis for disqualifying his...
Well, look, I use this in explaining that. Mm-hmm. Here's the deal. Mm-hmm. I'm a former international police officer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry?
Were you Interpol?
Well, there you go.
Okay.
That's exactly where I was headed. Okay. I've had people say... Interpol. No, that's a completely different organization.
Mm-hmm.
International police work under the United States Department of State.
Okay.
All right. It's not Interpol. Interpol is like international FBI.
Uh-huh.
Okay. International police are actually boots on the ground police,
mm-hmm.
and they go into these war zones. Where they're trying to rebuild and recruit new police officers and build a new police force, and you have to train them. But somebody has to go out and do policing while all that's happening.
Yes, I understand.
And so international police do the boots-on-the-ground policing and training, recruiting and training the new police.
Right.
Okay. So that's what I was. But I have had people introduce me to someone and say he's former Interpol.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how many times I correct that, I still get introduced as Interpol. And I've never, ever been Interpol, nor have I claimed to be.
Okay.
However, If somebody decided they wanted to come down on me, they could say, well, we've checked with Interpol, and he's never been associated with Interpol. Of course right. I haven't. I never claimed to have been.
That's right. That's right. Right. It's this kind of wordplay, you know. It's neurolinguistic programming, basically, you know. The manipulation of words and the meanings of words and sounds to make people believe what you want them to believe, but not really what is real, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what part of what I point out in the article on the UFO smokescreen and the Robertson panel, that Mike Wallace was quoting a little snippet of their third conclusion totally out of context. And then in part two, which came out today, I hope you got to see it, UFO smokescreen part two, I go into the Robertson panel, which is called the Robertson panel in one context, as it was a committee advising the Air Force, but it's got another name under the CIA. And all of this is in the article. And so what I did is I did NLP backwards. I extracted all the distracting information, the asides, and then I recomposed the real message of the Robertson panel, which is UFOs are serious. The reports were tying up our communication systems, which in 1950 to 52 were pretty primitive, basically phone lines with women pulling out the jack and putting in the jack, right? So it was overwhelming the communication system, and they were worried that the vast numbers of UFO reports that were coming in would act, could be used, in fact, to stunt our ability to respond to a real attack. And they discuss the distinctions between real hostile maneuvers and basically feints, you know, false attempts. And I said to myself, you know, for a phenomenon that doesn't exist, how is it possible that it could pose at some future time a real, actual, hostile threat, and then a false threat or a diversion at another time? See, so the whole thing logically is very inconsistent. It collapses on itself because lies tend to do that. Lies need more and more energy. The bigger the lie, the more energy you need to sustain it.
Oh, yeah, and it continues to grow.
The Kennedy assassination and the others, you know? Uh-huh. It's all part of the same syndrome.
All right, now, we've only got three minutes until the next break. And I would like for us to touch on this breaking news. You said this whole thing has set off a firestorm around the world.
Yes, okay, here it is. France and the United States are in this thing together. They're the big players now because of what happened with Laurent. And Laurent has a lot of friends. So all of a sudden this last weekend I received a letter from a gentleman in France informing me that a Rear Admiral, Gilles Pinon, of the French Navy had written an open letter to President Nicolas Sarkozy requesting disclosure and a completely new, unbiased scientific investigation based on a particular philosophy of science ascribed to Professor Karl Popper. And so I received the email and I started reading it, and the translation into English wasn't as eloquent as I would like it to have been. So I wrote back and I said I would like to see the original in French because I think that I can improve, you know, the translation. And the gentleman wrote back to me, I'm going to put you right in touch with Admiral Pignon. He will write to you. He's a good friend and a great gentleman and a serious man. And so the Admiral wrote to me, and he thanked me very much. I speak French. I read, write, and speak French, Spanish, and Chinese. Maybe it was that thing at Fordham University, you know? Uh-huh. But I have a facility with languages. So I wrote back to him in French, and we've achieved a rapport. And he sent me his original letter, and I will be publishing it in both French and in English in UFO Digest sometime in the coming days, I would say in about... I'm hoping to do it by next weekend. But he's very happy to have a supporter in America, and I told him I respect him and I admire him for taking such a courageous stand. And so that is, it's coming. Now, the reason it's coming, and I'll make this very short, is that the source tells me that the governments have received an ultimatum from those guys up there. And they said, look, either you're going to tell your people or we're going to make an open manifestation and they'll know that you are all a bunch of liars. The situation is serious, and this is what their demands are. Inform your people that we exist. Prepare for diplomatic relations by the year 2013 and prepare for our arrival by 2017. Okay? Now, these are not the Greys that we're talking about.
Okay, the break is going to take over in 4 seconds, so let's let it do that, and we'll get into all of who are they and what does their arrival portend on the other side of this break. And folks, it's going to get deeper, it's going to get more interesting and more fiery here as we get into this. All right, we'll be back.
I feel fine. Yeah.
The Kevin Smith Show selects one of its very best shows each week and turns it into a free podcast? Well, it's true. You can download free Kevin Smith Show podcasts right now and get a free fresh podcast each week. Do you want to start building your own library of Kevin Smith Shows? All you have to do is visit our website at kevinsmithshow.com and click the free podcast link. They're yours for the download. We're back. We're talking with Robert Morningstar. And, Robert, you were telling us about this connection you now have with an admiral in
yes.
France. And
yes.
Now he wrote this letter to the president of France.
Yes.
I understand you're going to do a retranslation of it, but again, give us the gist of the letter.
The gist of the letter is that the phenomenon, and he's talking about France, the phenomenon has been observed in France since the 1950s. You know, one of the greatest researchers in ufology was Jacques Vallée, who was really hot on the trail of this thing and wrote one of the best books of the era called Passport to Magonia, dealing with the fact that this phenomenon has been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, and he ties it into religion and to legend and to mythologies, things like incubus and succubus beings that leech sexual energy from people. He's saying, you know, this is not a myth. I mean, this is a myth, it's a legend, but this is exactly the same thing that's happening today in alien abductions. So it's the fact is that humanity has evolved to a higher level of maturity and understanding to be able to see this in a different context and to use a new vocabulary to describe it as we have advanced in science. So Admiral Pinon, P-I-N-O-N, his name is Gilles also, I guess it's a common name in France, Gilles Pinon, has asked the president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, who's an ally of the United States, to commission, to order disclosure and commission a serious scientific, unbiased scientific investigation of this. I'm in touch with many Frenchmen, including Gildas Bourdais. I wrote I didn't write it, I edited Gildas Bourdais' report on the rebirth of ufology in France. You can find that on UFO Digest, too, and he goes into some really fascinating cases. So UFO Digest has created a worldwide network of researchers, investigators, and interested parties who work together to keep the issue in the forefront of public consciousness and, as I asked before, to put the pressure on the politicians to do the right thing.
Okay, now,
you know,
you mentioned that there were some key points of the meeting and some key points, I think, of the Admiral's letter. I was unclear about where they came from, but the key points, one is that, okay, you guys have got to disclose our presence to the people. Number two, you've got to do this by 2013, and if you don't, by 2017, we're going to be there.
Well, with 2017, they're going to be here anyway.
Mm-hmm.
2013, they want established diplomatic relations with the nations of the world. But if not, if the governments are not forthcoming, what they plan to do is just come down, like as in Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End, and just park a giant UFO, you know, over the Hudson River in New York where all the people can see it. Won't do anything, it'll just be there. And it's obvious that there's nothing that we can do about it.
All right, now what's the source of this information about these 3 points?
This is the same source. You know, you mentioned that, did you say his name was Grisling? Who talked to you about...
Oh, Dick Criswell.
Criswell, Mr. Criswell. Well, these are the people, Mr. Criswell, whom I don't know, Robert van der Klok, who is a former Army intelligence officer. He has met Source. I have met him. Sean and Clay are my contacts with him. So the contact is growing, and it was he who told me of these things.
Okay, so
the military liaison diplomat between the Department of Defense and the Department of State.
Okay. This would indicate, then, that there has been some communication between our government, our military, somebody, and this race of extraterrestrials.
Yes, exactly so. And this officer informed me of that, and that the briefings have had been held in Washington and thereabouts, and that they have been briefed by representatives of this extraterrestrial race, which is humanoid. They're more human. They're not the Greys. The Greys cannot be trusted. The Greys are, like another species altogether. They're into their own agenda and their own methodology, and it seems that there are alliances being formed between different groups to keep basically checks and balances, you might say, so that the Greys don't just overwhelm the world and take over everything. The Greys seem to me, just this is my own opinion of after 40 years of studying the Grey phenomenon, they're in deep trouble. They have a problem with their reproduction. They screwed themselves somehow. Maybe they engineered something that turned out bad, or had some kind of a nuclear war that damaged them. So they cannot keep their race going by propagating the way they usually did. They apparently have very few women. And so they need an artificial womb, or a surrogate, when it's a woman who's abducted and she's implanted and they come back and take it. I call that a surrogate. But the artificial womb, in my belief, is the reason for all the cattle mutilations. They always take the uterus and they always take the genital organs. And so they are in a very desperate situation to continue their race. I believe that the Greys are a dying race, and that's why they're here, manipulating genetics to try to keep their race alive.
But all right,
they don't have our best interests at heart, you know?
Okay, so this group that has conducted briefings with our military or with our government or however we want to term it, it's not the Greys. It's a humanoid race.
Yes.
And,
they're white.
All right, and they're saying that... look, you guys get it together, because by 2017, we're going to be here.
Right.
All right, so basically the deal is we're a fact of life. Get used to it.
Exactly. And apparently, see, they're far more advanced than we are scientifically, and I believe psychologically and spiritually. And they foresee that the current trend of global politics is leading humanity to the precipice. And personally, I don't think they give a crap if humanity just wiped itself out. But the destruction of the earth and the life forms and the oceans and the environment is something that is of great concern to all of them. Furthermore, any disruption of the natural order of the earth in the sense of perturbations of the gravitational field, alteration of the electromagnetic field. We have an intimate relationship gravitationally and electromagnetically with the sun, and thereby anything that we do on Earth, the nuclear explosions, the disruption of the electromagnetic fields, the holes in the ozone, anything that we do shakes Earth up, it shakes up the sun a little bit too. And if you shake up the sun, you're shaking up Venus, you're shaking up Saturn, Jupiter, all the moons. So, we're not in this alone, but they have a hope that they can stop this trend and this direction of consumption and destruction and power sources that are based on destruction, you know?
Uh-huh.
Solid rocket motors. I mean, I used to love the space shuttle. But now, you know, I realize, like, that is the most poisonous thing that we have ever created. I put my hand over the space shuttle when it's launched, and I just look at the exhaust and the poisons and toxins that are being poured into the Florida sunshine and falling into the oceans that are full of life. You see?
And, you know, it's very interesting to me that in all, what's the space shuttle been in service, what, 20 years? 30?
1981 or so, 79 or so was the first test, I think, I remember.
All right. And in all that time, we've come up with no better way to get there?
Well, here's the part that's really the other, you know, the part of the catch-22. There are many people and many sources who say that we have a secret space program that is light years beyond the space shuttle, and the space shuttle is just a PR thing, like, you know, some pap to feed the public.
All right, we're going to pick up there when we come back, and we'll be on Final Approach when we come back. And you don't want to go away. We've got more information coming your way with Robert Morningstar.
At the gateway of the sun, with our love, soared among the clouds. We had just begun a night in Machu Picchu, where the mountains touch the sky. Oh, oh, a night in Machu Picchu, where the stars were in your eyes. Oh, oh, a night in Machu Picchu.
Did you know the Kevin Smith Show selects one of its very best shows each week and turns it into a free podcast? Well, it's true. You can download free Kevin Smith Show podcast right now and get a free fresh podcast each week. Do you want to start building your own library of Kevin Smith shows? All you have to do is visit our website at kevinsmithshow.com and click the free podcast link. They're yours for the download. We are back, and we're talking with Robert Morningstar. Robert, again, I don't know, it's your first time to be with us. I got to tell you, the breaks are hard breaks. They happen, and it cuts our mics off.
That's okay.
And so I didn't plan to interrupt you at each point where we did. We just had to.
That's all right. I don't mind.
Okay, so the year 2017 is quite interesting, mm-hmm. because that puts us past the much talked about 2012.
Right.
There are a lot of people that think that 2012 is going to be this massively destructive year in which basically most of human civilization comes to an end.
Mm-hmm.
What this race of extraterrestrials is saying would sound to me as if they don't expect that.
Exactly. I think it's a sign of hope, isn't it? That they're saying, look, things are going to change and they're not going to be so bad because we're going to come here in 2017, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
do we know who they are and where they're coming from?
That I can't say. I can only say from what my source told me is that they're very white, very pale. They have the ability to shapeshift, basically, to make you comfortable, you know, to make a human being comfortable. They can assume a shape that will not terrorize you. Yeah, but it can only be maintained for a short period of time. For example, it's like concentration, the deep concentration to be able to sustain an image in your mind's eye.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to say that now this, you know, I respect and admire a lot of people in this field. Not all, but quite a lot of them. And one of them, who's a real professional, I think he's really gotten very far in understanding the abduction phenomena as it relates to the Greys, is Dr. David M. Jacobs.
He's been a guest here.
Oh, his work is fantastic. And I say that because I've experienced my own experiences, and to read them reported in Dr. Jacobs' work says to me, wow, this man is he's really on target. And one of the elements is this, the psychic element and the mental element. I won't say mind control element, although that is manipulation that they do use. But the telepathy, you know, people don't understand. When you say telepathy, you know, they think like I'm telegraphing a thought to you and you're telegraphing a thought to me. It's not like that. It's like the Vulcan mind meld. Telepathy is in between two people. It's a duplex event. And this has happened to me, that in an encounter, your ego is overwhelmed with this new experience, this being. And your ego, basically the ego is a coward, you know, and it freaks out very easily. But we have something deeper as human beings, which is the soul and the spirit. And that when the soul and the spirit govern the mind, the ego can be suppressed and its reactions, its fear, can be overcome. So when a telepathic event happens, let's say an abductee with a gray, most people are not educated in psychology. They just see this freaky thing happening to them. Terror comes in. Another part of the terror is the smell. Those guys stink. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you smell something bad, you have an instinct to run for your life, you know, if it's toxic. Well, you're paralyzed and you can't. And you're overwhelmed. So this telepathic thing happens, but people, the ego is paying attention to the immediate event, and it's being communicated with telepathically by this entity who is kind of feeding back by feedback. He's searching your mind for what you believe and what you understand, and then creating information that will make his job easier. Basically, that's it, you know? You know, anything to calm you down so that the gray can get his sperm sample or his egg or, and then take it away and do whatever he wants to do. But the thing is, telepathy is duplex. It's a simultaneous event. If a telepath invades your brain to impose, let's say, the mind control part, they want to impose an idea on you, or an image that can be projected onto your visual cortex to make you see something that isn't there. They don't realize that, you know, your soul and your spirit, it's in that telepathic state, and you're going in there too. You're knowing what they know. When you come back, your ego is in shock and may not remember anything but the immediate event, but your soul and your spirit comes back with knowledge that it's extracted.
Well, and we saw that, albeit in a rather hostile manner, in the movie Independence Day, where the role of the president does a mind meld with the alien,
mm-hmm.
and comes away understanding what the intentions and agenda of this alien race were.
Mm-hmm. And, is this Independence Day?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah, where he's standing down in the laboratory at Area 51.
Uh-huh.
And that alien comes to life and kills the scientist, and there's a meeting of the minds between the president and the alien.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes.
And he understands that they intend to annihilate Earth.
Mm-hmm. You know, something like that may have happened to Mr. Forrestal, you know, Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, who was killed at Bethesda Naval Hospital.
Yeah.
They said he jumped out the window.
Yeah.
Well, no, the man was murdered. You know, after 50 years, I was able to acquire the Board of Inquiry report. And it's pretty clear to me that someone was sent up there to murder him. That he was lying on his bed, and when they found... See, they say he jumped out his bedroom window.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't go out the bedroom window. He went out the galley. His bedroom windows were sealed. They said that he tied bed sheets together to form a rope or to climb out. He was on the 17th floor, and it was actually his bathrobe that was knotted around his neck. There was an ashtray that was broken. The glass was on his bed, and the glass was on the floor. And this ashtray, the glass part, was heavy glass piece that sat in a stainless steel receptacle. You know, like in the 50s, everybody
mm-hmm.
smoked, so they had those ones with handles. They stood about, let's say, 2.5-3 feet high.
Yeah.
So... the poor man obviously got clocked on the head while he was in bed, and then
choked.
Choked and thrown out the window. And it's a terrible, terrible thing. And he's the man that had direct access to all of the information in Roswell. Some people believe that he had an encounter with the ET.
Man, I hate to do it. We're out of time. Robert, I thank you for being with us, and I hope you'll come and be with us again. It's absolutely been fascinating. We just don't have enough time, and I want you to come back, and we'll have more time. Stay on the line with me for a moment, if you will. Ladies and gentlemen, my friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until tomorrow, so long, everybody.